Mr. Director General, distinguished delegates, dear colleagues and friends, it's a great pleasure to stand here again in the Red Room. And for a subject that is so dear to my heart and that we have been discussing at FAO for at least 20 years, if not more. A subject, I think, which more than any other current issue is fraught with difficulties, with misunderstandings, with great hope, and with missed opportunities and wonderful challenges. So let's see where we are today and where we can go from here. Since the dawn of agriculture, of course, men and women have been selecting species or individuals from species in terms of getting better characteristics for human use. Bigger apples, stronger animals, more fully filled ears of corn and wheat. It was actually only 1.5 centuries ago that that visual phenotypical selection led to something else, to a better understanding of the laws of inheritance, starting, of course, with Georg Mendel. And for a long time, slowly statistics came into the equation because there is a probability of inheritance. It was only about 60 years ago when we started to unravel the mechanism of inheritance with the discovery of DNA, the molecule that actually is, in a way, the blueprint of life and the blueprint of inheritance. And then things became rapidly different. The 1980s saw molecular biology, synthetic biology, and as of the 1990s, the first work in genetic modification started. It was, and still is, a revolution as well as a continuity of man's working with nature. To understand what we've done so far means understanding how genetics actually work. And that, unfortunately, is complicated. So bear with me. Now, this conference is about biotechnology. And biotechnology, as the DG said very clearly, is not the same as genetic modification. To put it very simply, biotechnology is an enormous toolbox with lots of different tools that somehow, in some way or other, make us understand and unravel the characteristics genetically that make up the actual plant or animal and its performance. Genetic modification is a subset of that. It actually allows the introduction of, if you want to use that word, alien or foreign DNA into the DNA of the desired individual. You cannot do that without understanding the genetics. And the real breakthrough came actually only in this century, and that is when we started to sequence entire genomes of plants and animals. Starting with humans in 2003, the last decade, or a little over a decade, has seen a tremendous scope and a tremendous result in getting these full genomes sequenced. So that means actually understanding the whole of the DNA, not understanding it in the sense of knowing every characteristic. But we know now the DNA, the genome of all the major cereals, of apples and plums and tomatoes and cocoa and banana. About 80 crops are now fully known in terms of their genome. And for animals, it's even more. There are about 140 types of animals that we have now sequenced. From horses to cats and dogs, but particularly, of course, relevance here, goats, pigs, chickens, you name it. First chicken in 2004, and we have only had 10 years to achieve that. And it's a marvelous achievement because it's like knowing a dictionary. It's like knowing the letters of a language. It's only through the genome that we can be far more precise and target the different characteristics that we want to know. Genetic improvement exists only if there's variability, if there are different individuals with different characteristics. Otherwise, if everybody would be identical, there would be no genetic improvement. So biotechnology is a combination of techniques that allows us to better target the kinds of characteristics we want. Let me make that clear by a number of examples that are immediately relevant to small farmers and poor consumers. I think the thing is that's foremost in our minds is, of course, nutritional quality. enhancing nutritional characteristics. The most famous example of that you probably know, it's golden rice, a GM crop, so genetically modified. It contains a fragment of DNA that actually codes for a precursor of vitamin A. Simply put, it's got a yellow color, it's got vitamin A, which wasn't there before. Currently, there's work also on these characteristics for cassava, and getting a GM cassava is probably around the corner if it's not already there. Why is that necessary? Why can't we do that differently? We cannot, because rice does not contain any coding, if you want, for vitamin A, and it has to be found somewhere else. And it can only be found in crops or in plants that are quite different. So you have to introduce a different piece of DNA. In the case of cassava, there is an additional complication why genetic tools are necessary. Cassava doesn't flower very well at all. So it's very difficult to get new generations with new characteristics. So in the case of poor flowering or no characteristic in the original crop, GM techniques, genetic modification, are the tools you need to use. In terms of terminology, let me just say there is a big confusion. Genetic modification yields transgenic plants, transgenic being different from the original genome. Sometimes it's called manipulation, but that is, I think, more a loaded word than scientists like me would like to use. Now, another interesting aspect in that nutritional improvement is the recent case of purple tomato. Tomato, as you know, contains lycopene, which is an essential set of ingredients, antioxidant. But interestingly enough, tomato also contains genes for two other antioxidants. However, these are silent. And this is something that happens in the genome that we did not know about before. Sometimes the genes are present, but they need to be opened in a way. It's like opening the pages of a book. So by using genetic techniques to wake up those genes, we get a purple tomato with much better quality. The result is not genetically modified tomato. It is a tomato that has undergone a kind of genetic transformation, if you want, only to wake up genes that it already had. So it's still the same genome. We'll come back to that difference in a while. The most important application, however, is not on nutrition. It is on pest and insect and disease resistance. Viruses, bacteria, and fungi, of course, hamper very much the expression of the yield, especially for small farmers. And we've seen a surge in applications which all carry the name BT before them. BT derived from a soil bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis, which actually confirms quite a few properties that protect the plant against certain insects. A good example is papaya in Hawaii, where half of the plantations at one stage were wiped out through ring spot virus. GM papaya, because this is genetic modification, because a piece from the bacterium is actually introduced into the papaya genome, has helped tremendously to revive the plantations. Sadly enough, of course, I should hasten to add, that was not acceptable everywhere and to everybody. So the case of papaya, in many ways, is on hold. We have more examples, and the best example for African farmers is, of course, BT maize, now introduced in countries as far away from Sudan, Burkina Faso, South Africa, and being a success. Another case, an example of what these genetic tools can do, we find in potato. You remember the story of potato being wiped out by Phytophthora in the 19th century, causing the death of one-third of the Irish population. That disease is still around. It's very difficult to find resistance. The resistance does not exist in the potato that is grown normally. But the resistance exists in a wild progenitor of potato, say a wild relative, an uncle if you want. And through a process of that's called cisgenesis, a piece of the DNA of that wild potato is actually put into the potato. And that has had enormous results. It means that after 50 years of trying to breed for a resistance, we now suddenly have three types of resistance, three genes, if you want, that help to protect the potato and help the potato to win the race with this Phytophthora, which is such a very difficult disease. Another example of the types of applications that we can think of is in the flowering of fruit trees. Now, you know, if you want to improve a tree, it often takes generations, not just generations of trees, but generations of humans to actually get the right tree. By using a gene from a plant, actually a model plant, Arabidopsis, we can actually shorten that period of the new generation of, by having induced early flowering. So instead of 30 years of fruit tree breeding, we can bring it down to about 5 years. And after that period, that gene can be taken out again from the fruit tree so that the fruit tree itself and its fruits are not genetically modified. It's the last generation that you then allow to grow. In animals, we have similar types of results. One important area is of course, disease resistance, for example, in porcine pests. But other areas that you might not think about are two. One is the definition or the defining the sex of the chicken already in the egg by introducing a gene from a jellyfish, a luminescence gene, which allows you to see through the egg the sex of the chicken. What does it mean? That you can eliminate all male embryos and therefore you don't need to kill the male the chickens after they are born, because male chickens, as you know, do not produce eggs. Very simple, more humane, more animal-friendly technique. Another vast area of application is in the area of vaccine production. Vaccines through the introduction often of genetic modification in the virus itself, such as for blue tongue or Rift Valley fever, allows to produce a vaccine that is not dangerous but confers resistance to the animals. So there are indeed many applications. Think also of new areas where we are not just looking at animals and plants, but also at bacteria in the gut of animals, helping to reduce the greenhouse methane emissions from the stomachs of cows, for example. So sequencing of pathogens and bacteria is actually a new area here. Another area that we should consider, which is immediately relevant, is the use of waste. Waste, as you know, contains lots of fibers, particularly cellulose, lignin, which can be broken down by bacteria. Genetically modified bacteria help to make that waste more palatable as animal feed. So how have small farmers benefited? Well, let me say, first of all, of the 18 million farmers that are using genetically modified crops, which is a subset of what we're talking about, 90%, 90, are small farmers, according to FAO definitions. And what have they mostly benefited from? From pest and disease resistance, the BT crops, leading also to a reduction in pesticide use, from improvements in nutritional quality, improvements in shelf life, in storability of products, so that they can be brought to market very much. What hasn't been very successful yet, but is in progress, is work on improved taste, complex nutritional qualities, and particularly the issue of climate change. Yes, we have a drought-resistant maize that's very successful only in recent years, but the entire issue of climate change hasn't been addressed very well. Now, before I go on, I need to explain something about the breeding techniques themselves. Because so far we have talked about the toolbox and genetic modification. But there are some extremely exciting, very new developments that are extremely relevant today to small farmers, but also to regulations and countries as we are here today. We have, if you want, three ways of doing our breeding. One is just classical plant or animal breeding. You cross the lines, you hope for the best in the next generation. The other one that we just saw is genetic modification. You introduce a piece of DNA from somewhere else, and you get a transgenic crop or animal. But the third way actually supersedes that and makes it the story completely different. And that is what we call new breeding techniques, or if you want, precision genetics, I'd like to call it. It's actually having a pair of scissors that allows you extremely precisely and efficiently to cut the DNA at the place where you want to be and to introduce changes. Introducing changes in such a way, remember my example of the purple tomato, that the end result is not a genetically modified crop. There is no strange DNA. It's only waking up silent genes, or it's using genes for a while and taking them out in the process. So sometimes, technically speaking, we have a mutation, but it comes from the DNA itself, and sometimes there's not even a mutation, but only, if I may call it, the waking up of genes. Now, I know some of you may be bored by this time, but this is an extremely important difference, because it means that we have a process to actually conduct changes in the DNA without producing genetically modified organisms. And that is very, very important for everything we have to do with regulation. That technique is called CRISPR, and sometimes it's called CRISPR-Cas. Cas is the related protein. That doesn't matter so much. But to give you an idea, where genetic modification is like MS-DOS on an old computer. CRISPR is like supercomputing or Windows 10 and beyond. It's a completely different ballgame. It's precise, it's exact, and it's efficient. And more importantly, it can be used in any organism's DNA. Interestingly enough, the CRISPR itself, so that protein sequence, is part of the natural immune system of bacteria. It was actually a way for bacteria to protect themselves against viruses, and that is why it is so precise. But here comes, of course, a dilemma, and the dilemma is, how do we regulate that? We suddenly have a third category of biotechnology that doesn't fit all the regulations we have so far. Now, I need to add one or other complication to that, and that is the issue of food safety, so dear to your heart, I think. Risk assessment can use actually some of these precise techniques to see whether a product going to the consumer is actually genetically modified or not. It can also look at whether something is contaminated or not with other types of viruses or toxic products. So the assessment techniques actually also evolve, and that is very important for poor consumers who often have poor quality food. Now, of course, all this doesn't mean very much for farmers unless we put it in the context of their entire production system. So we have a number of unresolved problems here. And they are not technical, not scientific, as much as they are political. And that's, I think, why I need to put them forward to you. One is the whole issue of intellectual property. Who actually owns the results of this work? And this is a tricky issue because apart from, you know, farmers having done their work, scientists having done their work, it's obviously companies, particularly large companies, that have a stake here, have done a lot of the research. We have here two opposing political and legal regimes that some of you may be familiar with, breeders' rights and intellectual property rights. They are in a way opposed because breeders' rights allow scientists to go on with the results of research, while intellectual property, patenting, does not allow that unless a fee is being paid. Now, breeders obviously want some protection, and governments that do not allow that protection will see that breeders will be more hesitant to bring their products to markets. On the other hand, obviously, you also need access to what is considered in a way, the inheritance of mankind. So this is an unresolved issue. That issue is related to something else, and that is the speed of the whole process. It takes now about 14 years in pre-regulation processes, 1-4 years, and it takes maybe another 10 to get the regulation organized everywhere. That is far too long. That's a whole generation of farmers. Now, one of the problems in regulation is that we have, again, two opposing regimes here. We have regulatory agencies that look at the process. So has DNA been introduced or not? If so, it is GM or transgenic. Or they look at the end product. Is the end product GM or not? Say, simply put, that's the difference between the US and the European regime, and many countries are somewhere in between there. That's also something that is really quite urgent to resolve, particularly because the risk is, if we do not resolve it, that national regulation will actually redo some of that process. The bottom line. The bottom line is that we have a very complex process here, which is political as well as technical. And it comes as no surprise, I think, that it is so difficult for society to follow these huge steps that science is taking, and for politicians to have the political courage to move forward in an area which seems in many ways very risky. What are the societal concerns we should address? First of all, there is a sense that big companies dominate the market, that in a way, if you want to put it in a loaded way, this is a plot, a neoliberalist plot to keep small farmers and poor countries off the market. I'm talking not of my ideas, but of perception. But it's a big issue, this perception. And it is true that small companies are just only emerging in this field, particularly in Asia and to some extent in the US. Secondly, the perception is that this technology is not very useful to small farmers. I've indicated that there are many areas where small farmers benefit, but there are some areas where the focus is not on small farmers and the results are only indirect. In particular, the concern is that small farmers will depend on seed and create even a greater dependency on the market. That's not exactly true because farmers are used to using hybrid seeds, so that problem can be laid to rest in some ways, but it's still perceived very much. Then there's the concern about transparency and labeling. Now, this is a difficult issue. We can do it, even better so with the new techniques. But big companies are loath to do that very often. And secondly, there's ample evidence that giving more information on labels does not necessarily lead to greater understanding. Now, there are also a series of other risks that we addressed even in the past here in FAO. Human health, animal health, environmental health. So far, there is no evidence from a scientific perspective that there are any risks, and mind my words, that there are any risks with this type of biotechnology that are greater than the normal risks that we accept in classical plant breeding. But proof of absence of risk is not proof of the contrary. I hope you see the difference. But we are a long way from 20 years ago when the first GM herbicide-resistant soy and maize came on the market for large-scale zero-tillage production. As I said, 90% of the farmers are benefiting, or 90% of the farmers that are benefiting are small farmers. But still, four crops dominate, and they're all feed crops. Food crops are coming behind, but only slowly, particularly rice, potato, and tomato. There is quite a lot of stuff, if I may say so, in the pipeline, but it is fraught with difficulties when it comes to regulation, 20 years or more. So the issue is urgent. What can we do to make sure that poor consumers and poor farmers actually benefit? What needs to be resolved? Let me give you a few ideas here, which I hope you will discuss. First of all, I think we have to understand that with the delays, the current delays and even future delays, we are targeting not today's small farmers, but the next generation of small farmers. And that generation needs to be more entrepreneurial, more professional, because young people will not want to remain small farmers if they can help it. So this technology needs to be part of a far larger package of agricultural development. Secondly, we need to resolve some of the biosafety issues, particularly with CRISPR. This new genetics allows far better targeting for small applications, local applications, but it needs to be able to come to the markers. Thirdly, we need to do something about that controversy between breeders' rights and patenting. It's an unresolved issue for many reasons, I know, but still, we cannot go on this way. Next, we need far more public-private partnerships. This cannot be only a government issue or only a private sector issue. This needs collaboration, especially to get smaller companies with local clients and targets onto the market. And we need more research, long-term focused research on the needs of small farmers, poor consumers, on issues of climate change, of quality, of nutrition. We need to acknowledge that some of these techniques are scale neutral. They are applicable, like BT, to small and big farmers. But we need a far longer term commitment and funding to really do the trials, do the work in the field. And we need this in a systems approach. And then we need a social dialogue. This is an issue with lots of misunderstandings because it's complicated. And we need to get that resolved. That's not a matter of us scientists getting out of the ivory tower. It's a matter of working together to identify the issues and try and resolve them. The social dialogue is as important as the science today. And then we need to resolve things, I think, in an international forum. And that be my last comment. I think it's extremely appropriate that we are here at FAO. This is in the heart of FAO's mandate. It also requires us thinking about the international agreements that we have that touch upon this. Think of the CBD. Think, of course, of FAO's own bodies, but also other bodies that are in some way or other touching here. And maybe what we need to think about these days is a kind of platform to get the different parties together and talk about what kind of regulation is needed in the future. Unqualified optimism as well as severe pessimism are incorrect in this case. The devil is in the details. It is probably the most important issue for the future of food and nutrition. We have to resolve it politically and technically. The future is already here, but it's not evenly distributed. And we must make sure that everybody has access to technology that betters his or her life. Thank you very much.
Deputy Director, distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor to be standing in front of you here to speak on a topic that is very important to all of us and to me as well. I think it was President Obama, at the time of need, had some President Clinton speak on his behalf, and he dubbed him explainer-in-chief. And I think the scientific community had just gotten an explainer-in-chief in Louis Fresco, who did a marvelous job of explaining a complex issue on the agenda of biotechnology in a way that is understandable and clear to all. Before I start my comments, let me give you greetings and regard from our dear friend, Ambassador Kenneth Quinn, who is the president of the World Food Prize Foundation, who wanted me to remind you and to remind myself that this agenda of science and biotechnology was an agenda that was extremely important to Norman Borlaug. And the legacy that he's left behind is this advocacy for science and biotechnology to help in developing countries' need for advancing agriculture. I was invited to speak about the work that I had done, for which I was recognized with, to illustrate the value of science and technology in addressing problems of developing countries. But instead, I opted to speak on the debate on biotechnology. Please bear with me as I would go through this. My hope is that the debate would not end, not because of what I say, because of the concerted effort and this start of a meeting that FAO has put together to address this. Over the last 30 years, as Louise had clearly indicated, significant investments of resources, energy, and intellect have been invested in advancing and expanding the development and use of products of biotechnology to benefit agriculture worldwide. The discovery of the double helix structure of DNA by Watson and Crick in 1953 and the Utility Patent Act of 1985 that replaced the Variety Protection Act of 1970 were catalytic, providing the impetus for this ambitious investment by major chemical companies that ventured into the seed market. The seed discovery, the DNA discovery, inspired the ambition, and the Patent Act suggested solid protection to any potential investment by the private sector. Impressive gains were made in development and deployment of the new biotechnology product, catalyzed by the unprecedented levels of financial finances from the private sector, particularly in the United States. The private industry saw opportunities and invested heavily. There were public investments as well, though that was disproportionately much smaller. These combined investments yielded advances in several areas associated with the field of biotechnology, such as molecular biology, molecular genetics, genetic engineering, market-assisted breeding, and more recently, in genomics. In the early years, the most dramatic advent, however, came from the field of genetic engineering through the creation of transgenic crops, where through recombinant DNA technology, genes or genes from an organism are introduced to the genome of another plant, sometimes across different species, genera, or even kingdom. The first successful commercial release of transgenic products were made in the mid-1990s. The release and launch of GMOs was made with greater fanfare in the commercial seed and farming industry that is sustained to this day. Genetic engineering and its derivative commercial products of insect-resistant BT and or herbicide-resistant corn, cotton, soybean, and canola have altered the face of agriculture in the last 20 years, particularly in the Americas. By all accounts, there have been great market success, benefiting farmers and the private industry that invested in the rollout of these technologies. As a result, multinational companies such as Monsanto, DuPont, Dow, and Syngenta have dominated the market and in so doing also become, for various reasons, become household names around the globe. Unfortunately, from the beginning, genetic engineering technology and its product have been hounded by fierce debate around the world. These debates centered on a few critical issues. One, whether there are potential adverse effects of GM crops on the environment. Two, whether food products from GM crops were safe for human health. Three, whether GM crops were needed to address the world food needs. And four, a concern that these technologies and their products are subject to intellectual property, and hence, if GMOs are as good for the poor as they are for the rich. All along, and from the beginning, I felt that the GMO debate were irrational, unfortunate, and misplaced. And I'll try to explain. Early debates were actually sound and rational. But over time, the fervor of the debate got too strong. The demands to assess the potential impact of the products of the technology on the environment and human health were reasonable by any measure. The global academic and research communities took this charge seriously and conducted several independent research with consonant objectives and analyzed over time to see if any adverse effects could be shown from growing GE crops in the environment, or if GE grains cause harm to animals or humans feeding on them. Various thoughts and perspectives on the topic were also analyzed in dialogues held on ethical and social issues of people across the globe. The human health and the environmental concerns were addressed by repeated observations and an array of empirical studies, with nearly all results suggesting there are no associated harm to the environment. Suspected ailments to the human health also could not be established as cause and effect tied to genetically engineered crops or to any predictable or observable bodily reactions. The ethics, social and emotional reactions and issues of people remain hard to address, however. As lay communities entered the fray, the debate rapidly moved away from the public good intent of how well to mainstream new products, powerful scientific tool to the service of agriculture, to a name-calling by the greater NGO community, and to an economic and political quagmire that got harder to unravel or understand. As a result, these scientific results have not been managed to change minds of a significant sector of people and organizations around the world, and unfortunately, particularly in Europe. In spite of the repeated negative results that showed no adverse effects from several experiments conducted in different geographies, accusations and condemnations increased. That such a strong sentiment would consistently be expressed against GMOs in the face of overwhelming evidences to the contrary made the sustained debate appear and feel irrational to me. The debate has been mired with confusion and filled with irrelevance. It eventually got harsher, creating a huge chasm between the two global powers of science in Europe and North America. While these two great powers of science and knowledge debate very eloquently and cleverly, I might add, and knowing fully well what to say or not to say to each other and what's at stake, those in poor nations may have gotten too confused by the noise. I have heard that there is an African saying, source unknown, that goes somewhat like this. I quote, "When two elephants fight, it's the grass that gets killed." End of quote. Another aspect of the irrational debate arises from its moving target by some sectors that seem to want safety assurance not only on current technologies, but also on future products. Since there is a limit in risk assessment that could be made, unintended outcomes could arise sometimes and to only certain individuals. The social and biological consideration that can be made on human and environmental health or the social norms to consider are also just too many to offer any guarantees. The debate also became an unfortunate saga, created by the confusion around the terms assigned to distinguish the technology. In the euphoria that ensued the scientific breakthrough, the industry took a miscalculated risk by choosing to label the new transgenic products genetically modified organisms, and seemingly to draw attention to the great power and novelty of the new transgenic products. Liberally added later were the terms biotechnology or biotech, affectionately, and genetic engineering. That this technology would be given such a vague label was unfortunate, that they were promoted to mean genetically engineered and to also mean and implicate biotechnology, molecular biology, even modern science, or all manipulations of a live organism by man to create new crop cultivars, including plant breeding. Where are we today? As the fierce debate on GMO continued, farm areas planted to these technologies have expanded. It is estimated that over 180 million hectares of GE crops are grown annually, but greater than 90% of the acreage is in the Americas, 75 million in the US, 90 million in South America and Canada, and 15 million distributed in China, in India, and 20-some other small developing countries. Conservative estimates of the current market value of GE crops stands at around $20 billion annually, growing at about 12% annually, and is expected to grow to $35 billion by 2020. The current state of biotechnology is therefore a mixed bag. On the one hand, over 20 years after the first commercial launch of the technology, the global agricultural industry is only marketing products based on the very same two primary genetic events, BT and herbicide resistance, providing traits of insect resistance and herbicide resistance to a mighty herbicide glyphosate inserted into four high-volume marketing commodities of cotton, corn, soybean, and canola. Although a couple of other traits have been introduced to a handful of forage and horticultural species, neither the market value nor the acreage of these crops has been significant, however. On the other hand, the science of biotechnology has advanced immensely in the last 25 years. In spite of a slackened growth in public funding of science and applied biotechnology research, significant advances have been made in recent years in molecular biology, in genetic engineering, in genetics and genomics, as well as in plant breeding. Now, even more powerful genetic engineering technologies have emerged with genome editing, RNA interference, synthetic biology, whole genome sequences, each of which has the potential, once approved, to be directed to producing an expanded set of crop traits that potentially could address the many constraints of agriculture that could be applied to vital crops of the poor. However, the ethical considerations of the new biotechnologies, particularly with gene editing, where the national genome is edited, fixed or cleansed of its limitations through genetic engineering approaches, allowing the new cleansed up version to be passed on to unsuspecting future generations of plants, animals, and humans, brings with it very strong, serious ethical consideration as well. With lessons from the past, there is an encouraging development curve taking place, where scientists that are in the forefront of these new technologies have taken deliberate and wise actions to proactively begin dialoguing with each other, with the stakeholders, and with policymakers. They want to make sure that science informs a greater public, as well as policymaking, as to the potential and the implications of forthcoming technologies on ethical and social values, as well as on human health and environmental safety. These scientists will like some of these issues are considered in advance of commercial launches that may be in a very few years from now. Regardless, it's very likely that the debates about genetically engineered crops and livestock will continue on two major fronts. First, the social and ethical consideration on the newly emerging biotechnologies will likely to develop with even greater fervor. Second, while even more dramatic advances are made in science, sadly again, a vast swath of our planet with a growing, rapidly growing human population is drudging along without science. Ladies and gentlemen, contrary to what you may have heard, the poor in developing countries are truly hungry for science. For them, science in its many forms, if designed and delivered with greater appreciation of the reality and context, it would enhance their lives and livelihoods and add immense value. However, the challenge of formulating an appropriate science, technology, innovation to help the cause of the poor is great and needs to be done with greater focus and care. The global development leadership has gotten it totally wrong with both conventional science and biotechnology in believing that it can export a magic bullet in the absence of internal research capacity. The debate about biotechnology for smallholder farmers can be an utterly misplaced debate. The debate focused on the products and not on science and the technology. It needed to be on science that solves problems and what we need to do to give it a chance. It needs to look at priority problems and look for the science and technology that is the most appropriate to address those. Unfortunately, the debate hovered over the fate of currently available commodity GMO products of BT and herbicide-resistant corn and cotton. The noise that is heard is that Africa is hungry and therefore it needs BT corn and cotton. Of course, that notion is absurd. Cotton and yellow corn are important crops, but neither is the staff of life of Africans. Insect resistance and herbicides are important inputs, but they are not the biggest bottleneck or the most limiting agricultural constraint for the poor. The commercially available technologies of transgenic crops have not penetrated the market in developing countries for obvious reasons. They just didn't fit the need in many regards. The current GE products have done wonders for the seed industry and big farmers of the Western world, but very little for the poor. Connecting biotechnology with hunger and poverty was unfortunate and wrong. More is needed to address hunger and poverty in poor nations. Similarly, more is needed to align better the interest of the poor with that of our agricultural industry. As an individual that has tried in earnest to shift the agenda in the direction of positive change in the long term, it seems to me the focus of the debate was on highly contrasting thoughts and perceptions on two fronts. And here is what I have been hearing. On one hand, the largest multinational private sectors that own the technology often suggest that they have been unable to introduce GE technology to developing countries, particularly in Africa, because of several barriers, including market restrictions, lack of poor contract laws, heavy state control, irrational custom duties, cumbersome bureaucracy, and of course, that heavy level of corruption. They seem to suggest if only they could get the regulations, the property right issues, and the legal instrument to protect the investment before committing to operate in that space, all would be okay. On the other hand, what I hear developing countries seem to be saying is that industry has products it wants to sell and would like for us to get the regulatory and governance instruments to entice them. But we haven't seen the right products nor their willingness to do anything else. And they add, we can use the knowledge and experience in seed systems, in business development, in crop protection, and even in the conventional non-GE corn hybrids that they used to have, that they dropped because the margin of profit for those products are too low for them anymore. But these two groups seem to be talking past each other, as there seem to be no traction or progress made for either. I have said to the industry leaders, work with them now, with what they need, even if it isn't profitable or lucrative at this stage. Sell them conventional non-GMO hybrids. Help build a small private enterprise system in seed. Help build the knowledge base. Develop the research and science culture in developing countries. In so doing, you prime the system, help them develop into a viable and profitable farm enterprises, and when they are ready and willing to accept new technologies, they would come to you with what they would need. For adoption and acceptance of new technologies, context is important. An understanding of the local knowledge base, knowledge of crops of importance in the community, the varieties they grow, the primary agricultural constraints and the risks involved, and what additional resources in credit, in insurance, in markets, in advisory capacities and services are provided to assist farm operations. These are incredibly key essentials for the poor. In many developing countries today, particularly in Africa, there is poor research infrastructure. The research team is underdeveloped. There is poor research culture and record. In 9 out of 10 African countries, the educational level of the agricultural research and extension service is poor. The extension service itself is inept and defunct. The seed production and delivery system has not been developed or even thought out. Fertilizer use is rate under 10 kilograms per hectare. Input delivery system is non-existent. in 3 out of 4 African countries, there is not an interdisciplinary team of scientists working together as a national crop improvement team, or may have linkages with extension service. Suffice it to say, in most African countries, little has been done to show the larger smallholder farm community the benefit of science and how science therefore can transform society. So in many of these countries that lack the basic human capacity and institutional strengths, lack of facilities or struggle to allocate the budget to lead research in conventional science, adding an additional dimension, demand to build a biotechnology infrastructure could be overwhelming. The debate is not whether or not the science of biotechnology in all its form is needed. It certainly is. The hard question is, who will invest in the technology for the poor? Who will produce the technology that addresses the local need? Who will train the new generation of biotechnology scientists? Who will build the need facilities for biotechnology? Who will cover the R&D investment in this new science? How do you put together a functional delivery system for new biotechnology products in a system where there isn't functional delivery systems? Who will advise governments to develop regulatory and policy framework that encourages science and biotechnology? There are many more questions, but in much of the loud, irrational, and misplaced debate, these kinds of critical issues have not been considered. It seems to me we may have not recognized it, but we had put the cart before the horse on this carriage. We need to reverse the course and get it right. There has been an opportunity cost to debate on biotechnology. There are lessons to be learned. In spite of the great promise made in transforming agriculture, that we only have 2 genetic events placed in a handful of commercial crops has been unfortunate for the cause of the poor. Industry has to do what it needed to do, but it was an opportunity cost nevertheless. Developing countries with some capability could not get a product that they could get excited about because it addressed an important constraint and it's affordable. That was not made possible. The greatest problem in this is the regulatory issues that Louise spoke about. Public institutions that could were cut out of biotechnology research because the regulatory and approval burden was heavy, and the benefit of the work could not extend to the crops of the poor. That was another opportunity lost, and it was not good. Important research such as golden rice and water-efficient maize corn stalled for years in the laboratory. As private investment in biotechnology research increased, funding for conventional agriculture research generally decreased, except in the new emerging economies of China, Brazil, and etc. The overall slack diminished the potential advances in agriculture, though conventional science. That was an opportunity cost. The great opportunity cost to me was in drying investments in public plant breeding, where many programs were shut down as senior scientists retired but were not replaced. Many public programs lost budgets in an unfortunate assumption that this was a charge of the private sector and not the universities. Though it has now bounced back, public plant breeding was made to appear irrelevant early in the biotechnology debate. That was, again, an opportunity lost. That enhanced benefits that could arise from foundational breeding, population development, as well as the combined effort approach now practiced through marker-based plant breeding could have possibly advanced and spilled over to poor nations. That was, and still is, a huge opportunity cost. So what's the way forward? There are many more new scientific tools emerging, and developing countries still cannot afford to miss them. They need to call for greater public investments in science from governments of wealthy nations, international agencies, foundations, as well as the UN organizations such as FAO and UNDP. But perhaps more importantly, governments of poor nations will need to tighten their belts and invest in science for their future from their own meager resources. In that vein, failure of 75% of African nations from fulfilling their CADA pledges of 10% of their annual budget to agriculture is pathetic and shameful. Poor nations need to turn their populace literate in science, educate the young in STEM education, train them and mold them to develop their intellect, become scientists, innovators, entrepreneurs, so that their nations will have the capacity to develop their own technologies or have the abilities to assess and adopt them from outside to meet their local needs. From what we have seen in the dawn of the 21st century, it is indeed a highly competitive and advanced global community that is emerging. We now live in a future where more than ever, the state of competitiveness for any nation will be linked with science, technology, and innovation, and how well it plays in the marketplace. When there are well-trained scientists in a nation supported to lead vital academic research and development programs, they would pursue research even in areas that their governments may not endure. For example, in as much opposition there has been to deploying genetically engineered crops in Europe, their scientists have been among the global leaders in the forefront of biotechnology research. Furthermore, one of the most positive things that have emerged in the last few years is commercial farming is a concept of coexistence led by USDA and the Department of Agriculture in the US. In a more democratic world that we all aspire to create, where we should respect not only our differences but also our preferences, our aspirational sustainable food system would likely accommodate and include the development and production of crops through genetic engineering, conventional science, organic farming, native grains and wild relatives of crops, and more importantly to me, is the acknowledgement that there is science indeed that would support and encourage all of these food systems for the benefit of humanity. The exciting possibility is that where these crops are grown and the manner in which they're managed is kept distinctly separate, avoiding accidental mixing, so to satisfy the consumer and get to their niche market, fetch their fair prices, and deliver through their unique supply chains. An emerging model is that as communities develop and attain certain degrees of sophistication, they tend to demand tailor-made services, and they do so by creating market demand. For poor nations to benefit from the science of biotechnology, they will need to accept science as an indispensable armament to getting their people out of poverty, that science, technology, and innovation are key to science-based development. Building internal human and institutional capacity is so fundamental, and in spite of unproven trajectories that would suggest ways to leapfrog some of the developmental planes, poor nations need to commit to getting it done the old-fashioned way. And that is that other nations and other knowledge sources could help, but only they themselves can build their own nations. To enhance adoption of new biotechnologies, each nation would have to build platforms and pipelines for technologies that they are able to visualize for their nation. They will need to build support services for their farming communities, as well as encourage innovation from within. Strong human capacity is key. Recruiting the best and providing them with the best environment for them to excel. Providing them incentives to keep them is a proven human resource management approach globally that needs to get entrenched in poor nations as well. Finally, public-private partnerships are important. Many of you assembled here today know that another science agenda that has shown a clear divide between the two otherwise well-aligned communities of North America and Europe is climate change. As in biotechnology, people may be given the same facts or evidence from science, but yet end up drawing different conclusions, or do not make the same choice, or necessarily show similar trust in scientific results, even when their personal interest is compromised. I understand that more Europeans do not believe in the threat of climate change, that it is real and mostly caused by man. Unfortunately, that does not appear to be the case with a large segment of the United States or the legislative branch of the U.S. government. Unlike the agenda in biotechnology, however, climate change is not as fiercely debated between Europe and North America although the chasm on it emerged. The implications are clear and long-term. As weather patterns continue to change, droughts and hot periods get even more frequent. Water aquifers lower, growing seasons shift, and new threats from insect pests and from diseases and invasive weeds emerge. We would need powerful science and biotechnological tools to develop crop cultivars and animal breeds that withstand these growing biotic and abiotic stresses. I assume that those that believe in the agenda are likely to make the needed investments to prepare for the expected. I believe that the world has great centers of knowledge, brilliant young scientists that ever more are turned in with wholesome social values to be agents of change and angels of service to humanity instead of the greed that had enveloped our planet and its varied communities in the previous century. We also have very more dynamic innovation centers and entrepreneurs in developed and developing nations to grow local economies. These centers of science and innovation and the bright scientists and aspiring entrepreneurs that work there are likely to deliver on the promise if given the chance. The forthcoming tools need not come from current or new transgenic technologies, but could arise from new genetic engineering technologies or from the broad range of arsenal that science and of biotechnology promises. Ideally, our scientific community would be able to provide an arsenal of tools with options and meet the needs in the social and environmental context of the community being served. But we have to start investing in agricultural science at a level commensurate to the huge threats that we now face in the face of climate change, including food and nutrition security, growing pandemics, land and water shortages, and compromised oceans. We need to do it now and not later. We've seen from past experience that sustained investment in agricultural research can bring about food security to nations so they may grow their economies and build lasting livelihoods. Today, new investments are needed from both the private and public sectors of the world. Private sector does best when it's important to its bottom line, and with great competition, often delivers great products and services. But developing and marketing just two commercial genetic engineering technologies every 25, 30 years is not the quickest way to meet the needs of the poor or address Norman Borlaug's unfulfilled aspiration of eradicating hunger from the face of the earth. Humanity has far too many acute problems of agriculture that the private sector might not and would not address. We need to call out for greater public investments in raising the rigor and fervor of science, including biotechnology, to address the many problems of agriculture that are not likely to be met by private sector alone. I'd like to end with this old and perhaps a tired phrase that states, quote, "War is too important a matter to be left to the military," unquote. It is a paraphrase of a quote attributed to George Clemenceau, a World War I Prime Minister of France. I'd like to borrow from this quote and run a corollary here to suggest science, innovation, and technologies are darn too important for the poor to be left to the private sector alone. A concerted public investment across many sectors, including in education and research, in a variety of agricultural sciences, in raising the scientific talent pool of poor nations, and in building strong and functional institutions is needed that would deliver on our unkept promise of delivering science for development in earnest partnership with the private sector. The global poor are hungry for science and waiting. Thank you very much.
Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor for us to present here the Brazilian case for biotechnology in action. And this presentation was conceived by Dr. Mauricio Lopes and me. And the idea here is to show to you a historical background of Brazilian agriculture development, and biotechnology as being one of the pillars for this advanced and science-based tropical agriculture. Yeah. So this presentation is divided into five sections. Firstly, the constraints to agricultural development in Brazil, then the key drivers for agricultural innovation, so as the motivation for changes and the implementations conducted. And then we going to merge for agricultural biotechnologies and their role in the development of Brazilian agriculture. And the coming biotechnologies in a nascent bioeconomy and the challenge for the future, and biotechnology as being essential for a more sustainable agriculture, particularly in the tropics. Right, Brazil, as you know, is located in a tropical environment. Brazil has a huge surface of soils that are acidic, poor in phosphorus, and also very poor in calcium, magnesium, important plant nutrients for crop plants, and high levels of aluminum that are toxic for the growth of crop plants. On the other hand, Brazil is located in this tropical environment, and it's a mega diverse country, showing high a richness of biodiversity, abundant solar energy, and a large supply of fresh water. But before the 70s, Brazil was not a food secure country. We suffered from low agricultural production and low yield. Agriculture was concentrated in the southernmost states only. And agriculture was the knowledge on tropical agriculture was very poor, particularly in soil fertility management. Agricultural development policies were not consistent, and Brazil was totally dependent at that time on international donations of dairy products. This was 1970s. And Brazil was known as a coffee and sugar producer. But despite its constraints, Brazil has developed a science-based advanced tropical agriculture. And the key drivers for that can be listed here in improvements in fertilizer recommendations and acidity control, availability of quality and certified seeds, governmental commitment and public policy for agricultural development, a landscape suitable for mechanization, availability of mineral resources, ironically with acidic soils, there is a plethora of mines for limestone, and nitrogen availability mineral nitrogen for mineral nitrogen fertilizers. Crop breeding programs started to be improved a lot that time. And the beginning here, one of the strong influences of biotechnology, the development of biological nitrogen fixation for soybean to be grown without mineral nitrogen fertilizer, which is still going on in 35 million hectares of soybean planted in Brazil. And finally, the farmer's will for entrepreneurship. These were then the key drivers for agricultural innovation in Brazil and led together with institutional building and strengthening, as you see, parallel to the development of Embrapa research centers all over the country. State research institutes were also available, providing a large network of experimental stations. On the educational side, federal network of professional education was developed, with agricultural faculties and technical schools providing agronomists, veterinarians, forest engineers, and technical experts. From the private sector, seeing that it was an adequate environment for business, Brazil was then, the private sector developed supplies for technologies such as fertilizers, pesticides, machinery, and food processing. As a consequence, results and impacts of these drivers in Brazil, we see here in line with our from 1976 when BRAPO was created together with other research institutions. We see here the London timeline from 1976 to 2040. We see the line of yield going up here from 1.4 tons back in the 70s to 4.5 tons per hectare for grain crops, average values. And the land used for agriculture remained steadily below 50 million hectares. So this is tremendous. We can say that in two generations, probably. Two generations only, we jumped from 1.4 to 4.5 ton, 5 ton of grain crops per hectare. If we had the same value of yield of 1970s today to provide the same amount of grains, we would need three times the area that is available. So instead of growing and producing grains below 50 million hectares, we would need 156.6 million hectares. So Brazil then became self-sufficient, but not only self-sufficient, as we see here in the green line for domestic consumption, but also became a relevant export country for different products. This has led also to an impact in the food basket prices. Here, the example of São Paulo state, the state of Brazil with the largest population in the country. The evolution here of the food basket prices from the 70s towards 2013, diminishing by 50% the price of food in the food basket of Brazilian population. So why is biotechnology important for Brazilian agriculture? Biotechnology is important because it enables us not only to overcome biotic, abiotic stresses and efficient nutrient use, but also because of the recent advances in the omics sciences that enable the identification of important genes for agronomical, forest, and animal production. And these genes can be identified and targeted to produce a vast array of things, improving breeding programs and providing us with advances in animal breeding, but also for production of vaccines in several areas listed here. One example of the advances of biotechnology and the recent progresses seen in biotechnology is the genome selection that was already emphasized in the first speech today. The genomic selection improved the forest tree breeding, as we see here for eucalyptus clones, that is a relevant source for paper production. So a strong public-private partnership between Embrapa, other research institutions, Brazilians and internationally, they engaged in a force to describe the genome of eucalyptus that consequently traits could be identified here for growth and newly selected elite clone could be developed and already having an impact on forest productivity compared to the previous elite clone. This process diminished the time for selection from 12, 16 years to below 8 years. On animal reproduction, here we see the India's cattle that came to Brazil in the beginning of the last century to improve cattle production for beef and milk production in Brazil. And today, with the advancement of biotechnology, genes of cattle for genetic material can now be exported for specific purposes, for meat production and also for milk, which in this case has led Brazil to provide India with genetic resources for zebu and these Bos indicus to produce milk in India. Another advancement of the biotechnology that enable the efficiency in agricultural products in Brazil is for biofuel. The second generation ethanol was improved with the Amyris engineer yeast producing farnesene, a biofuel, from sugarcane biomass. This happened parallel with an environment, a legal framework that was conceived by 2005, 2006, in which Brazil could offer a more reliable legal framework to approve and to judge the technologies that could be put available to the society, to the production system. Here we can see the creation or the format of the Brazilian National Biosafety Council with the National Biosafety Technical Commission in yellow, and below the different internal biosafety commissions in research centers, and following up to the National Council of Biosafety, and in which we have representatives from not only agricultural ministry, but human health and environmental as well. This then led to several commercial approval biotech products in Brazil. Here you see for corn, cotton, soybean, common beans, and eucalyptus, but also enable several commercial approvals, for example, animal vaccines, 20 events, yeasts for second generation ethanol, 6 events, and the one that is that Brazil is in dire need is the suppression of population of the tiger mosquito that cause dengue fever and Zika. Here I'm showing to you along the years from 1998 to 2015, the commercial approval of biotech products in Brazil. You see that there is a large increase after 2007 with the implementation and the organization of a legal, a reliable legal framework in which we see the events, different kinds of events, mostly agriculture and for forestry production, but also enzymes, animal vaccines, and human vaccine as well. Last year, also, several events, field tests, were approved for implementation in the field. And adoption. Adoption of GM technology in Brazil is reality. Here you see for annual crops, over 60% of adoption, in which for soybean is over 90%. Farmers are seeing GM technologies, GM plants, as a possibility for them to cultivate in a less risky environment. That's the main driver for them to adopt this technology. On the side of capacity development in biotechnology in Brazil, this is the first biotech crop developed in Brazil in an open innovation system with a private and public partnership for the development of the soybean, of the cultivar soybean resistant to imidazolinone known herbicide that led us to the possibility of diminishing the weed pressure by these three weed plants here, and in combination, rotation with the glyphosate-resistant soybean could be then enable soybean production in a less risky environment regarding weed pressure. And in a solo flight by Embrapa, a public company, this is the first biotech plant developed in Southern Hemisphere. This is the Phaseolus vulgaris. This is the common bean. It's a staple food in Brazil together with rice, and mostly grown by small holdings. And the bean golden mosaic causes annual decrease between 90,000 to 280,000 tons. And Embrapa developed a golden bean mosaic resistant plant. So the field trials were approved in 2011 and commercial release by 2016 here now in central region of Brazil. And the immediate impacts are going to be less use of pesticides to control the vector of this disease, which is the white flea Bemisia tabaci, and less risky production. And there is a strong demand by smallhold farmings for this technology in Brazil that is going to be available pretty soon. And now we're going to emphasize the opportunities for biotechnology in a nascent bioeconomy. Today we see agriculture as being demanded not only for food production, but agriculture is demanded to be more multifunctional. It's not only food, fiber, bioenergy, but also for green chemistry, biomaterials, and agriculture is also regarded as and considered to be relevant in environmental and ecosystem services. So then biotechnology can be relevant to in several fields, to vaccines, genomics, cell culture, tissue culture, medicines, pharmaceutical products. Actually, biotechnology can help us to diminish the time to develop products that will be available in several areas of the society. An example here, a biofactory, is the transgenic soybean that is developed within Embrapa. The plants producing cyanovirin that is important for HIV treatment. So the commercial use, the commercial production of this crop plant is under discussion with the private sector. We believe that in less than 2 years, we're going to make it available. And again, advanced biofuels, second generation, making the process 20% cheaper. Human diseases. The dengue fever, chikungunya, Zika virus, having the vector of Aedes aegypti, the tiger mosquito, can be controlled by Bacillus thuringiensis, a soil bacteria that kills the larvae of this insect, diminishing the controlling the adult population. This is already going on in Brazil. Final message would you like to deliver? Advanced technologies are essential. Agriculture, sustainable agriculture, cannot be reached without the recent technologies, particularly with biotechnology, because we need an agriculture that is economic and environmental and social sustainable, a lower ecological footprint, and mimic or enhance natural processes. We need an agriculture that add value to natural processes and biodiversity. But as we know with the recent technologies and following the talk of the presenters before me, we need to emphasize or we need to improve our communication skills to diminish the taboo that is raised when we have new technologies being used in agriculture. And new agriculture technologies must not be seen as a problem, but as a solution and key component in the path towards a more sustainable future. Thank you very much.
I think it's very important that in this debate we enlarge the discussions to the very narrowly defined biotechnologies which only seem to look at a few plants and a few animals. Ladies and gentlemen, bio depends on ecosystems. We need to understand the ecosystems as such and find the greatness of the ecosystem which gives us solutions we can never imagine in a laboratory. And let me just give you a first example when it comes to golden rice. In Brazil, Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Sul and Rio Grande, we have developed a study. And the study of Rio Grande shows us that if you want vitamin A in your food, you do not need to genetically manipulate the rice. You only have to harvest the microalgae that grow in the water that you use for the irrigation. All and behold, we found out that there is 12 times more vitamin A and beta-carotene in the microalgae in the rice water than ever you could get genetically into the kernel. So my question is, do you want something that is poorly designed and not so efficient, or do you want to get the farmers double the income? And to me, the key is, are we securing that there is income for the farmer? Yes or no? And we have to put ethics sometimes at the core of this. I ask any country to never permit any company that sells you seeds where the farmer is prohibited by contract and even is taken to court if he keeps seeds from that specific seed. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, that's ethically incorrect. We have to permit the farmer to do what the farmer has always been doing. And therefore, I am very firm. You cannot hide behind the accusation of corruption and inefficient bureaucracies that therefore this is not permitted. I must add to you that in 1994, when I started in Tokyo, I was invited by the United Nations and the Japanese government to assist in the design of business models that would have zero emissions, hence still the name of my organization. I was asked to do that and created over the years a network of 3,000 scientists that I call the think tank. And we have, on the other hand, 850 implementers. We call that the do tank. We combine the thinking and the doing, and it is a tremendous honor to know that while 20 years ago we were considered to be absolutely useless in thought, that we do have 200 projects implemented, $4 billion invested, and 3 million jobs generated. And in the end of the day, if we don't keep job generation as a top priority in whatever we do, we're not serving society. We're not serving society because we're securing returns to hedge funds. The biotechnologies must be at the service for all. But here you see the animal that impacted me most in my life. I set up 12 corporations myself. Two went bankrupt. One of these corporations took on Procter & Gamble, Henkel and Unilever for the production of soaps, biodegradable soaps. I was very successful because I took market share without advertising. You know, when these fast-moving consumer goods don't see advertising, they don't understand how it works. But I had invested a 3-year budget in advertising in the first zero emissions factory, a factory that had no waste. In 1992, my whole car fleet was running on biofuels. I was a bit early. But when I realized that I had become the biggest buyer of palm oil, and the Indonesian government hosted me as a VIP in Indonesia, in Kalimantan, I realized that while I was this green entrepreneur, and had this ecological factory, unfortunately, I realized I was destroying the rainforests. I was destroying the habitat of the orangutan. It is very important that business, if they want to do business, business can never foresee all consequences. Never. In any innovations, there will be unintended consequences. Now, as long as you didn't know it was the consequence, then you're free to go. But the moment you know that there is this consequence, then it becomes collateral damage. That's ethically not permitted. Unfortunately, industry today, backed by major investors in the world, particularly hedge funds, are not prepared to take that responsibility for the unintended consequences. And therefore, in my view, the world will redefine their license to operate. This is what I saw. This was my picture from the plane, where on one hand I see the rainforest, on the other hand, these monocultures. Unfortunately, I had to realize that biodegradable palm oil is not sustainable. And it's a very unfortunate thing, but then you create these forests, which I call empty forests. Nothing grows in there, except the GM tree that you put up. You know, how could we ever sustain a growing need for food and jobs in this world if we create empty forests? And I must say that with Brazil, I do not understand the obsession of genetically modifying eucalyptus. Why? Because Brazil has the largest world's biodiversity in bamboo. And we have demonstrated to Embrapa before that on one hectare, you can generate 60 times more fibers over a 100-year period than you can ever do with a GM eucalyptus that grows in 8 years. Bamboo is simply much more efficient. But if there is an institutional technological lock-in, if the money is only going for eucalyptus and pine because the paper process that's behind it can only take that, of course they're not going to go for bamboo. And of course there's not going to be a private-public partnership in that case. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to look reality in the eye sometimes. We have to say what is not popular, and some will even tell me that's not politically correct. Doing less bad is bad. If I'm telling you that I've been stealing and I'm called to the judge and I'm telling the judge that I'm going to steal less, you think the judge will consider me a candidate for early release from prison? Of course not. But when we have companies that pollute and contaminate and don't want to take risks beyond the very narrowly defined logic of risk, and they're saying we're reducing risk, and they're saying we're polluting less, then I must say you're still polluting. Polluting is polluting. Polluting less is polluting. Stealing less is stealing. Where is the logic? How can we sustain a double moral along those lines? And therefore, I must sometimes say that I'm ashamed of how we have developed our food industry. Look, these chicks, I don't understand how we've come to the stupidity and to me even the insanity to have chickens, one day old chickens, flown around the world with jumbo jets in order to have then a higher efficiency in transport. Of course, we don't want to have the males when it should be the female, and we don't have a female when it should be the male. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, why don't we let the males and the females live? One for the meat and one for the eggs. But we don't do it because we have genetically transformed those chickens to the point that the male that comes from the egg-laying chickens cannot even walk. So what do? Yes, I'm happy to see that you're now injecting something from an octopus in order to see early on if it's a male or a female, because that's indeed an improvement from the shredding of chickens that we do still today. Ladies and gentlemen, we're shredding billions of chickens every day. We don't realize it, we don't want to know it, that's fine. The Germans have suggested instead of shredding, they should gasify them. I don't get it. Official policy of the German government in 2015. Now, we have to just ask ourselves the question, how come we don't succeed in letting both of them alive? How come that we can lose sight of this 50%? And let me go to another thing, and I'm going to poke in you and be uncomfortable for another 5 minutes, and then I go to the more positive news, okay? But if you give a man a fish for a day, he will not be hungry. If you teach him how to fish, he will overfish. So the hard reality is, not only do we overfish, we enjoy eating the eggs of a fish. Can you imagine that we would have a farmer go with a cow to the butcher to slaughter it while the calf is going to come in a couple of weeks' time? I mean, I think in many countries that butcher and farmer would be put in jail. We would not tolerate it. With fish, we do it all the time. Oh, it's because it has hair and four legs, it's okay. I mean, how can we have a fishing system where this is a delicacy? Now, if you kill the females with eggs, plus do overfishing, how sustainable is your fishing technique? Now, do you think that genetically modified tilapia is going to solve that problem? I wish you good luck. Because then you get into the hands of a food business that has only one interest, to sell the feed. We have this persistent drive of cutting costs. We have to start looking at generating more revenues. And we need to have a persistent drive to respond to the people's needs. May we put it as a priority? This is the United Nations, right? May we have society as a priority? And that requires new business models, and that requires different searches for technologies. And we've heard from three speakers one type of technology. Let me add you what I do. You know how the whales fish? With air bubbles. The whales are capable of designing an envelope of air bubbles around the krill that permits them to catch all the krill that has no eggs. Smart. How come we can't do that? Well, we can. I have not only been involved with a team of about 30 researchers to design this, but we have just done the first tests in Peniche in Portugal, where we are fishing with air bubbles. And we fish with air bubbles, and when the fish is coming up, thanks to the air bubble, we scoop them into the boat, and then we check the females if they have eggs. And the females with eggs go back to the sea. Doesn't it make logic? I mean, how do you think productivity? We ran the test in Peniche, and then in El Hierro, in the Canary Islands in Spain, we did a test for 2 years. Fish stock jumps up to the level of 1974 in 2 years' time. Why? Because we don't kill females with eggs. Now, are we ready to do that kind of research? Is money available for that? I'm funding it totally privately because the governments think that this is not the way to go. And therefore, we have now gone into the next phase as the design of the new boats. Because if you fish with air bubbles, then you have to have a catamaran. And so we're now designing fishing boats that are based on catamarans. I can guarantee you that catching pelagic fish with air bubbles is an easy thing to do. Now, if you don't need to pull the nets, and you don't have to freeze the fish first, you save 80% of the energy. That means this boat will be the Tesla of the fishing industry. But the cheap version of the Tesla. Why? Because we can now process every fish on the boat. We redesign, everything is done with seawater. We do not need fresh water anymore. We save 250,000 liters of fuel per year per boat. Now, when I'm with the Minister of Marine Resources and Fisheries in Indonesia, and she learns this, she says, I need one boat for every island. That's 17,000 boats. You know, we have lost vision that there are opportunities to change our food base, our protein search, and generate a complete new types of industries that not only work with the ecosystems and its regenerative capacity and not against it. And we can relaunch the shipbuilding industry in the meantime. In Indonesia as well, I would like to share that we are regenerating mangroves these days. Mangroves were, they used to be the shrimp farms. You remember the shrimp farms that were massively invested in, and then the white spot virus attacked and all the shrimps were dead, and then the mangroves were gone and the shrimps were gone. 75% of the business evaporated, and of course the European Union, rightfully so, didn't like the introduction of those antibiotics. But this is how it looks like. We have now the first 100 hectares of mangrove regenerated in East Java, outside of Surabaya. And you see that when we plant those channels. And in those channels, we have shrimps, which we don't have to feed. Nice. Shrimps, which you don't have to feed. Do you think we're competitive? Hell yes, we're competitive. And so this is where we try to act on. But since we know there are rising sea levels because of climate change, the encroachment of the sea level water into the land is also very pervasive. And therefore, we need to look at the opportunity to create a hybrid salt-resistant sea rice, which grows naturally in China. And here, ladies and gentlemen, here is the first harvest of 158 hectares of sea rice, where we only use land that has been encroached by the sea, and where countries do not have the money to build the dikes and the dams, which costs billions, and many countries just don't have the resources. The Chinese government is leading this, and we're very happy to see this development. You know, we need to think about farming the sea in another way, and not only stare so blindly at the land. And so we have introduced the last few years the concept of 3D sea farming. The same logic as we have it with the mangroves. You regenerate the ecosystem you produce without having to feed them. Nice. That's competition. Nature is restored. Now, when we restore nature and we put nature back on its evolutionary path, we can move. Now, here, this is in the United States. This is Brent Smith in the front of his 3D sea farm. We're in Connecticut, we're in New Haven, we're in the United States of America. And there, we've introduced a farming system which is very simple. If you want to restore a sea that's been overfished and with these nets going over the bottom all the time, where nothing grows anymore because we've put it to death by our greed to make money. When we come to that point, we now see that we can introduce the kelp, the seaweeds, the scallops, the mussels, we can put the fish traps on the bottom, everything works. You know what the advantage is? Our biggest cost is the ropes and the buoys. We don't have to put any money in feed. We don't need enzymes, we don't need things to control the lice on the fish. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, would you like to see what the cost is of this? I mean, it's so ridiculously cheap that most of the people think it is not possible. And I know many of you are going around and say, what Professor Pauli is saying can't be true. Let me invite you to come and see. I'm not going to debate it. I'm not prepared to debate the science of what we're doing. I'm prepared to show the doing. Because we need to move into doing. And that is very important. Now, we are focusing on these four basic species from the sea because they're on the bottom of it. If you want to regenerate your food ecosystem at every trophic level, you're in need of starting at the basis. And that is mussels, scallops, oysters, seaweeds, sea urchins, you name them. If you don't have them, go to fish farming and then be happy that you approve a genetically modified salmon. I'm happy if you can do that. But on a cost accounting base, I'm a third of the price. What are you interested in? I'm not against anything in this world. I'm in favor of what is better. And I need people to think about the research. Now, we have emptied the top already. We need to start rebuilding the oceans from the bottom. And this is what we do. Wageningen University is leading this. Very controversial professor is saying that with 180,000 square kilometers of 3D farming, we could feed the world with all the protein we need. That's the space in front of Washington State, okay? We have a capacity to generate nutrition beyond what we know. Now, how much research is going into this? Very little. But what I can show is what we've done. And these are not lab scale. These are businesses that operate. And the beauty is, of course, that as it was rightly indicated by Pedro, what we have indeed seen is that you're not just in farming scallops and seaweeds. You're into cosmetics, in animal feed, you're in all these other products. But let me remind you, no inputs required, no pesticides required, no herbicides required, no fertilizers required, no seed companies required. I mean, it's quite a different business. And of course, I understand anyone who's in that business doesn't like the proposal. We need, on the other hand, coastal defenses against these rising sea levels. And what I've been sharing with you is really, what is climate mitigation and biotechnology? And it's the ecosystem that we can regenerate where the real technology is. Because the insight in how this works offers us tremendous opportunities, not just to generate the jobs, but to also mitigate the rising sea levels. Whereas the time I have doesn't allow me to go into more detail, I will talk tomorrow at 5:30 with the students about it. How do we regenerate coastal systems whereby the rising sea level, at least for the next 100 years, is not going to dramatically affect us? But then we have this plastic soup, you remember? I mean, wonderful product of, this is what I call an unintended consequence. No one knew this is what's going to happen. But when it happens, none of the companies who made this takes responsibility. Amazing, isn't it? I mean, where is the ethics gone? So what we see is that there will be 250 million tons. Nature magazine earlier last year said there's already 100 million tons. But we're adding every year another 8 to 12 million tons. Now, what is interesting is we know that we can collect the plastic soup, 7 different types of plastic, and convert it with pyrolysis, low-temperature pyrolysis, into carbon black fuel and syngas. But it's very interesting that new research at the University of Washington in Seattle has indicated when you have these plastic beads, there is a surface tension with a positive and a negative charge that generates a tiny 5 to 10 micron layer of fresh water. And you know, in nature, whenever there is fresh water and salt water, there is dynamics because everything gets a bit stressed. But there's more nutrition, different types of nutrition. So now we know that the algae growth around the plastics is exploding because of this water that's generated by these plastics. Now, that is a research that you don't find yet in Nature magazine, and if you Google it, you will not find it either, so therefore it's not valid for most of the people. Although I can show you the results, and we're working with it today. Fresh water in the ocean attracts a whole range of microorganisms, which are unique, and therefore the fish eat it because not they like the plastics, or they're confused by the plastics, because there is so much microorganisms growing on the plastics thanks to this sweet water, salt water combination. That turbulence, that makes it. So we're turning that around because these are the microorganisms that extract phosphorus from the sea. This is interesting because agriculture, we know that the N we can get, the K we can get, but the P, we're running out. And Africa still has good reserves of the phosphorus, but it's coming to an end. And so therefore, we're focusing on how can we, and this is our business proposals, how can we clean up the plastic soup while harvesting phosphorus without destroying the bottom of the sea? Now, that's the kind of work that my organization does. The plastics get harvested while harvesting phosphorus. Now, we don't need to have any sorting systems, and we have good fuel. We've been running these installations now for 2 years. 2 years, 2 tons a day. We don't do things in laboratories. We do them. Because if we are not certain, then don't do it. If you're not willing to take the risk, don't do it. But we move. Here's the installation. Now, what we are seeing is that with 100 tons of plastic soup, we generate 85 tons of fuel. And we can generate 50 cubic meters per second of upwellings through this saltwater-sweetwater combination that gives us 100 tons of phosphorus per year. Low energy. Now, these are the things that is not large scale yet. Do you know of any research program funded on this? No. Do we believe this is the future? Yes. We're bringing consortiums of companies together to do this. And by the way, now we're generating fuel at high sea, and now we can supply fuel to the ships at high sea. It was interesting that the first candidate to buy this was the American Navy. They know how to do that. But this is the kind of things we work on. Now, it doesn't make financial sense unless you have the microalgae and the phosphorus. You need to have that multiple cash flow. And that is the big change from what we're seeing. A new business model is required that generates multiple cash flows. And let me go to the tea. I was received by Prime Minister Modi last Saturday. I was hosted by your government. And it was about tea. The Prime Minister has a great priority on the Northeast. He wants in the Northeast to see things happen. Now, the Northeast is quite incredible of India. I don't know if you've been to Assam. But in Assam, you have the largest natural park, which is a world heritage, where you have wild elephants, the largest flock of rhinos in the world, 2,500 rhinos, incredible collection of 120 wild tigers, and next to it you have tea plantations. You can only imagine the chemical runoff of these tea plantations into the park. So there the rhinos don't suffer that much until now from poachers, the rhinos were suffering from the chemical off-run. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a reality. So Mr. Ratan Tata decided himself that since he was the owner, he had the whole plantation go organic. This is the largest organic tea plantation. The bad news is that since this is a tea plantation that's been farmed for 135 years, there's no more carbon in the soil, less than 1%. So as a result, if you extract the chemicals from the equation, it is not working anymore. So I was asked by Mr. Tata, could we double employment within 3 years' time? Because if I do what our financial people tell us, I have to put 1,500 people on temporary contracts. And you know what means temporary contracts? Working 7 months instead of 12 months? That means you promote poaching. So, we started. Here you see the first result. This is tea plantation with trees. Every tree is growing pepper vines. We're producing pepper. 20% increase in jobs. Then you need to prune the tea, otherwise you don't have a fresh flush. All the tea prunings are used to farm mushrooms. We generate more tonnage of mushrooms than there is tonnage of tea by using what the tea plantation has. Now, you don't need biotech for that, you just need your mind for that. Just do it, implement it. And my son at the age of 3 learned already how to farm mushrooms. So don't tell me you can't do it. Don't tell me you need high tech. You just need to decide to do it. And China has been doing it for more than 12 centuries. Then in order to avoid the irregularity of the monsoons affecting the rain retention into the tea plantations, 18 retention ponds were created, and there we have fish. Because the Kaziranga, the Brahmaputra River, has the largest brooding region of the world after the Amazon. So we should promote at least a few of the 450 different fishes that are living there. And so we are doing it. We're increasing protein, increasing jobs. This year will be the first year this tea plantation makes a profit. And by the end of next year, we expect to have reached the target of doubling the employment around the tea plantation. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the technology of the ecosystem. Use what you have. Generate more with what's available. Use the five kingdoms of nature, not just the plants and the animals. The fungi are very efficient as well, you know. And let's not forget the microalgae. The teas will be launched internationally. But what is important is we double employment, we protect biodiversity, and we're competitive. I mean, at the end of the day, we need to be competitive. How can the tea in Assam be competitive on a world market when the drive has been cost-cutting? ferociously all the time. And now tourism can thrive in a different way. The problem we're facing, ladies and gentlemen, is core business. An obsessive focus by scientists and business on one subject only. Yes, and I tell them they behave like pandas. You know the panda, we love the panda. We love the pandas, they're plushy, they're nice, they're lovely. But you know, the pandas are endangered. Why? Because we encroached on their land, and now they don't have the bamboo to eat. But the panda really has a problem. It only wants to eat bamboo. I mean, if the panda were ready to change its diet, it would survive anywhere in the world. But the panda says, bamboo or nothing else. Ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly how business behaves these days. They consider it a risk if they have to go outside of their core business. They consider that adaptation to new realities in the world are not permitted. They want to take companies and governments to private courts under a very special regime. And I don't understand it. Why don't we simply behave like cockroaches? Ladies and gentlemen, cockroaches, they eat everything, anything, anytime. They've been around for 100 million years. They will be around for another 100 million years. And you try to kill them, you try to kill, you succeed one, you never kill them all. This is the mindset of how we operate. And let me exemplify that with coffee chemistry. This is my last example that I will tease you with. Do you realize, ladies and gentlemen, the inefficiency of coffee drinking? When you drink a cup of coffee in the morning, you basically only ingest 0.2% of the biomass that the farmer harvested. Can you imagine? A whole supply chain is organized for 0.2% of the biomass. Everything else, thrown away. Wow! But that means that if now we know coffee is a hardwood and the bean is a great substrate for mushrooms, then we do mushroom farming. Ladies and gentlemen, we have 3,000 mushroom farms around the world on coffee plantations. We think there's space for 1 million of them, at least. And mushrooms is cholesterol-free. It's the kind of food that you should be having. It has the essential amino acids. It can compete on protein, dry-based basis with meat. And the waste of the mushroom is enriched with amino acids, and that is a great chicken feed, as we apply. Now we are blending coffee in clothing. Ladies and gentlemen, functional clothing like Patagonia, Adidas, Hugo Boss is now buying the special yarns we produce where you blend coffee, 3 micron size coffee, and that is blended and used into textiles. And why do we put it into the textiles? Because it absorbs odor. We like that. Or do you want to spray your body with antiperspirants all the time? I think when you go out jogging, you like to have something that absorbs your odor. Timberland puts it in its shoes now. 20% of the Timberland sole is with coffee. Now, what does it mean? What is the price for a functional chemical like coffee in a sole or coffee into clothing? It's $2,500 a ton. How much do you think you get for coffee these days? You don't even get $500. It means we're increasing the revenue for the farmer by factor 5. We now blend coffee in carpets, nylon 6. Now we can add it in MDI to make polyurethane with coffee. And now we can put it into paint because coffee is also a UV protector, naturally. Ladies and gentlemen, the latest research has shown us that we're able to store in coffee grounds after you have eaten. If you have looked at it, now we can store in the coffee grounds methane and hydrogen. Now, it's very interesting. We can increase the value of the total chain with factor 500. That is the bioeconomy. That is high-tech because it brings food and nutrition as well as functionality. My last case, of course, I have to talk about Italy. This is a thistle. Cardo in Italiano, cardoon, le chardon. The thistle is not very well liked because it's considered a weed. In Europe, you have 20 million hectares of these weeds growing around because the European Union pays farmers not to farm. Now, if you pay farmers not to farm, what do you get? Well, thistles. So on the island of Sardinia, under the leadership of Dr. Katia Bastioli, who's our CEO, we start making bioplastics, including we're making pelargonic acids, azelaic acids, we derive from thistles, and these are the new herbicides. We make lubricants, and all the capsules in the future of Lavazza will only be biocapsules that we're using. The waste from our chemical process is animal feed. Ladies and gentlemen, the waste from our process is animal feed. And by the way, we're extracting enzymes from the flowers, which we use to make cheese. This is an 840 million euro investment done in Italy. You're in Rome. I suggest you come to Novara, or you go to Porto Torres in Sardinia, and you see how this is being implemented. We can give animal feed to the farmers at half the cost Brazil can give soy. That's competition. And that is what we require. But on top of that, this is being produced in the former petrochemical facility of Eni, Eni. We transform that into a biorefinery. To conclude, if we only teach our children what we know, our children will never be able to do better than we do. Therefore, I translate everything that we do and every project that we have implemented into children's stories, fables. I'm very grateful to the Chinese government because the Minister of Education of China and the Minister of Environment Protection of China have both approved all my fables for free distribution to all children in China. This is a gift I could never have imagined. But we're in need of inspiring a new generation of the technologies and the business models that are available, where ethics is at the core, where serving society is the priority. If we're not inspiring the next generation, what are you doing here on this earth? Ladies and gentlemen, with Nelson Mandela, I would like to conclude. It always seems impossible until it's done. And let me send you an open invitation to please come and see any of the projects that we have implemented. And from there on, let's enjoy this great future we all have. Thank you.